Session number 14806.
Eddie Murray, side 19.
That I felt that I was just that I wasn't terribly important at all, because the majority of the hard work had been done, and this was going to the final defeat.
How did you find the syllabus? I mean, how did you know what to teach?
Well, the major put me in the picture.
So you've got the timetable or something?
Yeah, I had the timetable and all the... And I had a safe...
And the course
in which
notes.
To lock everything. Mm. And the course lasted 4 or 5 weeks.
Yes.
But then eventually, when I got back to Calcutta, I was to meet, quite a number of people who'd been doing the same sort of work, but in a different place.
So they
were in transit.
Places.
Yes, there were
several
places.
Centres like that,
yeah.
I see.
In fact, there was another place that I was due to go to, and I got, 300, 400 miles away it was, and I did about 300 miles of it. I blotted my copybook. It was terrible. It was so stupid. Although, I suppose, destiny and fate, what would have happened to me if I hadn't blotted and made a stupid mistake?
So where were you? You were down training at this particular place, the chief instructor.
Yes.
And then you were sent off.
And I folded it. I folded it up.
You packed up, yes.
Packed it up.
Yes. So that was the last course.
That was the last course.
Right, okay.
You see. And so, and then we're getting into August, aren't we? Oh, yes, we're getting into August. Because I was in Calcutta for the 15th of August. So it didn't last terribly long, I was there.
And so you were sent off to do something else.
I returned to Calcutta.
And then you were to do something else, but the blotting.
Then I was sent off to do something else.
But you blotted your copybook.
In a place called Hazaribagh.
And what
was about 300 or 400 miles away from Calcutta.
Well,
you see, I'm given money, and I'm given a satchel locked to my wrist in admin, and given a key to the satchel. Then
but not to the handcuff. Was it literally handcuffed to
yes,
you?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, that's part of the story. This is, this is where
so
I...
So you got the key to the... You
I
got
can
the
never
key.
Forgive myself for having... I mean, it's so stupid.
You've got the key to the case, but not the key, to the case. But not the key to the handcuff.
No, I've got the key to the handcuffs.
Ah, right. Okay.
Well.
Okay.
And then somebody in admin said, you've been told all about it. You mustn't get rid of it. You mustn't leave it out of your sight. You mustn't unlock it. You must, it must stay there on your left hand. Whatever you do.
And this was...
In
so
Calcutta.
Yes, but you were going as a courier, was it? Or
in a way, yes. I was going up there to... I think I was going to stay up there, as a matter of fact, because it was another training post. One of the outposts, one of the training posts it was that I was going to. So what I was going to do up there, the orders would be there, or the orders were in the case or something like this. But in any case, this girl in admin said, you've been told all about it, you mustn't get rid of it, and you mustn't use the key at all. I know. And then she said, it's only mail for the personnel up there.
And this was what sort of establishment was this?
Oh, this is the ISLD headquarters in Calcutta.
Oh, and what the establishment you're going to?
Another ISLD place, just like I'd been.
All right, another training.
Another training place.
Yes.
Yeah, whether they train, I'm sure they trained people up there, but I never got round to find out.
Well, anyway, so.
Right. You see, and so I'm handed this thing. And I've got my luggage. I've got a case. I must have had a case. A case with me, with my own stuff in it. So, this 1500 weight truck took me down to Howrah Station, and there's an Indian. Gary Waller there, you see, driver. And Howrah Station's a big place, and I didn't have much time to spare. And so I unlocked the handcuff, you see, and left it beside the driver, and I said, there, look after me, I'll only be 2 minutes.
Oh, dear.
Only be 2 minutes, you see. I'm sure I had a case. What happened to it, I don't know. No, I think I must have left the case there as well. So, off to the ticket office, I went. And I wasn't there. Yeah, I mean, I had a warrant. You know, and so 2 minutes later, I'm off back. No truck.
What had happened?
I'm sure he was under instructions, do you see, that if ever I let go of the case, that he was to return to headquarters. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah.
But I said to myself, well, there he is, you know, gone. And my case was there on the ground.
That's so right. What happened after
so
that?
I picked up my attache case, my small case, and forgot all about the dispatches that I was supposed to be carrying. I don't know where my mind was. I was looking forward to doing, you know, to the shooting. Apparently that they had a very good game shooting at Hazari Bagh.
Mm.
And so there was the train puffing away, ready to go. So I dashed and showed my ticket and got into the first class compartment, you see, nobody else there. And off the train went. And 250 miles later, I suddenly remembered. No bag, no truck. So I went to see the guard and asked him if he'd, stop at the next station. He said, no, can't do that. Well, I said, you know, all right. So I went on to the station, which was, you know, probably about 40 or 50 miles away from the post. And there was a truck waiting, a jeep. A couple of officers, regular armour officers, do you see? Major and captain. Ah, Mr. Murray, where's the case? Where's the dispatch case? So I said, I've just realised, you know, halfway down the track that I left it in the garage, in the truck. Yeah, no, we know all about it. Sorry about this, Mr. Murray, you'll not be able to do any shooting, he said, because you have to catch the next train back. So I waited at the station and took the next train back to Calcutta. And so that must have been halfway through August.
And the Japs had surrendered by now?
No.
Not quite.
For about 3 weeks. So that must have been the beginning of August. Or end of July.
Mm.
And I was asked if I would, instead of lounging about, you see, waiting for the end of the war, if you like, and transport back to England, I was still, you know, on the
books. You got back, you went back to Calcutta, and then what happened?
Oh, I was given a choking up by the colonel, of course, who said that it was unforgivable, you know, and blotted me copybook really and truly, and that never again could I be given a sort of a responsible job until such time as I'd proved myself again, you see. And so I said, well, all right. And so I was asked to take over the mess.
Ah, right, okay.
And that's where I took charge of the mess. And we had apparently the best chef in the whole of India. And he used to produce wonderful, wonderful food. In fact, such food that any officers travelling up from Karachi or places down south of Bombay, anywhere, any officers that could get permission to come into our headquarters, and you know, it wasn't every officer that could.
No.
They had to be above the rank of major, or major or above.
And this was ISLD. ISLD.
Still ISLD.
ISLD mess, headquarters mess. Mm-hmm. Or senior officers.
Four senior officers. As far as
did they have a junior officer's mess?
Now, wait a minute. They had to be senior officers or members of ISLD, part of the staff of ISLD. Because I remember we had, so there was Captain Broadbent, for instance, who was RAF, and Lieutenant Mac, an Irish lad that I met eventually at Charing Cross Hotel later on. And so there were junior officers, but they were specifically part of the ISLD organization. And
whose mess was it? Was it an ISLD mess or
no? An ISLD
mess.
Yeah,
right. Okay.
Specifically, because this
but if you weren't in ISLD, the only way you wouldn't get through the door in any case unless you're a major or above.
And with an authority signed by the authorities.
Okay.
In Calcutta.
Right. Okay.
But because the mess became renowned throughout the whole of India as the best place to eat.
Right.
In, you know, in military places in Calcutta.
What hat badge did most of these people have?
Just the crown. The crown and the
general
general circle.
Right. What about the intelligence corps? Were they involved much in this?
Yes, very much, because we worked in, well, we more or less collaborated with Force 136.
Which is?
Another clandestine organization.
And what did that do?
The same sort of work as we did, as the intelligence service. They obtained, but they mainly worked with the French.
Force 136.
Yeah.
And where was that based then?
In Calcutta as well.
As well.
Well, on the outskirts of Calcutta like we were, but a little bit further up the road, well, a couple, 2 or 3 miles away.
Was, I mean, did Force 136, did one side do more sabotage and the other side did more intelligence gathering, or how did it work?
I never went into it. I just did what I was told, and in those circumstances, you see, and organized the food and the drinks and accommodation and that sort of thing. I did, well, you know, what anybody running a club would do.
Okay.
But I was also cute too, do you see, and helping Captain Brown with the... now, you must realize that they're not... This is not just an ordinary transit camp with ordinary officers transiting. These were people that were engaged in clandestine activities. And so, as before, some of them were going to be flown out and some of them were going by submarine and all the rest of it. And when they went on these secret missions, everything that they had upon them had to be left behind, you see. And in quite a lot of cases, there was a lot of destruction to do with personal effects that they left behind.
If they weren't coming back.
And they were never coming back. And so, and also a lot of, for instance, after the 15th of August, I tried to organize there a birthday party for myself on the 18th of August.
Right.
But I received firm instructions, no birthday party. If you want to, you know, if you want to celebrate your birthday with friends, because there were quite a lot of French, Foreign Legion friends in transit for Chandanagore, do you see? And they were in, they were on leave, for instance, in Calcutta.
Right.
Used to come from Chandanagore to Calcutta on leave, and also they used to have accommodation.
Chandanagore was the French, possession,
the French possession
nearby, or relatively
so,
nearby.
So, you know, 100 miles away. But so they transited via Calcutta.
Right. But you were basically said if you wanted a birthday party, you couldn't have your mates around the place.
No. There was an interesting thing arose. As I said before, there was a guard outside and a guard inside, and they were Indian guards, you know, with turbans and things like this. So they were Indian Army. And they were on duty there 24 hours a day. And on one occasion, nobody was allowed in unless they had a special pass signed by ISFD office in Calcutta. And so on this occasion, I came back from somewhere. I'd been out somewhere, maybe to the market, you know, but from somewhere I came in. And the sergeant of the guard said, "There's somebody waiting for you up there, Mr. Burry." I said, "Well, who is he? Has he got a pass? Don't know." But he said that he knew you personally, and we haven't let him inside, but he's sitting there inside the perimeter, sitting down on under the veranda, as a matter of fact. And so I said, "Well, you know, you shouldn't do this, and you'd be on a report and all the rest, but he should be waiting outside, you know." And I gave him a bollocking. And I went, and this, you know, this young man in British Army uniform, and he stood up, he was wearing glasses, and he was a sergeant. And so I started tearing him off a strip, you know, he knew, or he should have realized that this was forbidden access and all the rest of it, and he should have waited outside. And I'm railing off at him, and he said, and I said, "Well, who are you?" And he said, "Well, I'm your brother-in-law."
Ha ha ha. You'd never met him before?
I'd never met him before. He'd married my younger sister.
What did he make of this introduction?
And so he'd come to Calcutta and somehow he'd found out. I suppose he'd been in correspondence. So I was in correspondence with my family.
Yeah. But did he take that in good part, as they say? Or?
Oh, yes, he realised. Yeah. In fact, he was very impressed to know that I should have the authority, you see.
Right.
And should be able to give him a, you know, tear him off a strip.
Right.
As a sergeant, and he'd also heard me shouting at the Bahadur.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I didn't take him in. We just sat there and we made arrangements to meet that evening, and we met in town that evening.
You couldn't take it, you couldn't offer him a drink even round
the
back?
No.
What, you were Q2, so what stores did you have to deal with?
When Q wasn't there,
you're in charge.
You know, when something arose, then I was there. And so, and I helped him, for instance, in the destruction when the Japanese war was there. Mm. At the end of the war was there. Mm. Then we had such a lot of poison pills, for instance, to destroy.
Really?
And this was, really a job for two of us, because we had to watch where the smoke went and where the tablets were dropped. And
let's go on. I mean, what other unusual stores did you have there? Explosives, spy equipment?
Well, personal letters, for instance, that had been written by officers who were going away.
Yes.
And it was heartrending because we used to read them to see if there was anything being divulged, you see, if the Top Secrets Act, the Secret Service Act, or Secret, whatever, Official Secrets Act, was being infringed and that sort of thing. And it was heartbreaking because there were officers who used to send poems and songs and wonderful.
And that would be their last testament.
And, I suppose so.
Well, this was the letter they'd leave behind if they didn't come back.
Yeah, if they didn't come back. Yeah. And so if it was reasonable, you know, to keep it, then we would keep it and file it. But the majority of the letters that were left behind and the personal effects, you know, would have to be burnt and incinerated. And we had an incinerator there. We don't go into the morality of it. They were just becoming lost papers.
Hold on. These people, before they went out on missions, would put all their kit into a bag or a locker or a sack? Or
no, because their kit had been left at their previous place. This was just the transit place.
All right.
So they wouldn't have any kit with them.
All right.
And quite a number of them were regular officers.
Right. So their main kit would be at their
previous
their regiment or whatever it might have, or whatever it could be.
Yes.
Then they'd have their overnight, presumably just their overnight kit or something would be left with. Short stay kit would be left with you.
Yes.
Yes. And the letters that they left for their next of kin, if they didn't come back, were lodged with you.
It was censored by us. Or by Harry. Q.
All right. But were these the letters?
And if they infringed the Official Secrets Act,
then they got ditched.
They were ditched.
Right. But were you the ones that had the letters that they left, if they didn't come back at all, or we're talking about the same thing?
We're talking about the same
thing. Same thing, yeah.
Absolutely. Mm. Because they went out of there to their dispatching point, you see. And so when they left us, they didn't have anything upon them that would disclose the fact that they were officers.
Right. And presumably, I mean, they got things like wallets and jewellery and so forth were left with you, weren't they?
Well, they would be kept, you know, in a locked compartment for.
And then those would be sent. Those would be sent back to next of kin. What did they give them? Special haircuts, or did they do anything special with them before they went off there?
Yes, they all had. They were all treated, you know, pertaining to the area that they were going to. But I'm sure that they also went from there down to town where they had specialists for that sort of work.
All right.
But we didn't have hairdressers or anything like that.
I see. Oh, did they get a slap-up meal before they went?
No, it was never. No, they never mentioned the fact that they were going,
no,
really.
No, I see.
The walls have ears.
Yeah, okay. What other unusual kit did you have there?
Oh, well, of course there were. I mean, we had...
Radios?
Knives and radios, yes. Mm. And...
long-distance Morse, yeah.
Yes, there were... There's quite a lot of equipment, really, now that I think about it. But most of it, you know, when the Japanese folded in on the 15th of August, we destroyed a great quantity of...
So what, stuff. You had radios, knives, firearms?
I'm sure there were firearms.
Right, okay.
But the point, you know, the thing that I remember best was the amount of...
Suicide
pills.
So just tell me about those. How were they used? I mean, did they...
Well, I'm sure you've read about them or seen them on television, you know, with buttons and badges to put in your lapels and things like this. And false nails.
And they had a... what were they made? They were cyanide, were they? Cyanide.
Well, I suspected cyanide.
Yes. And you had to burn all these and keep upwind of it.
Yep.
And wonder who was downwind of it.
No, we had a special incinerator.
Did you? Yes. Yeah. And you were getting rid of documents as well in the incinerator. Mm. And what about register of documents? Who dealt with that? You or somebody?
That was Q.
That was Q responsibility.
Because everything was in Q's office, you know. I mean, he had a desk like this and everything was laid out there for him.
Did you have any particular unusual small arms, for instance? If not...
Not to
no,
me.
No, no, no. Okay. So that was VJ Day then?
Yes.
Did you have a big party or how did it happen?
No. No, we didn't. I remember going into town and meeting up with some of my Legion colleagues. And I remember one girl called Marks, Jeanette, or Janine. Janine Marks. I didn't know at the time her name, you see. But there they were, and I was in a major's uniform, as a matter of fact, on the opposite side of Chowringhee, which is the main street in Calcutta, going down to the Maidan. But they were on the opposite side of the road. And it's a wide thoroughfare. And suddenly I heard, you know, these legionnaires on the other side, dressed in Legion uniform, going, Murray, somebody had recognized me. So, of course, I went across, happy to see them again, and they all stood up to attention and saluted, all except for this girl that was with them. And she was in a PPO uniform, a French Fanny's uniform, if you like.
What did PPO stand for, can you remember?
Yes, Paillasson pour Officier.
What does that mean?
It means a pillar for officers.
What does it really mean?
No, I can't remember.
All right.
But in any case, there she was, Janine. And but she had one of these, you know, on a string, a crocodile, you know?
A real crocodile?
No.
No, I don't know.
One of these mobile crocodiles.
Oh, I know, a toy.
A toy crocodile.
Yes,
you pull
remember.
It up, do you see?
Yes.
And that turns the spring, the elastic spring or something, and you let it go down and it moves forward. And she had one of these blooming things, do you see? And she was playing about with it while being introduced to none other than myself. Do you see? And I took a dim view. At least you can blooming well. I'm going to have you, do you see? So I worked on it a bit and found that she was engaged to a bloke who'd been in intelligence.
Yes.
Supposedly to be in intelligence in Indochina in Via 3. And he was supposed to be in the Deuxième Bureau, which is the intelligence.
Yes.
And I found out afterwards that he'd actually been contemplating starting a cell and deserting to the Viets, you see. And so I put me all in, and we couldn't do about anything about locking him up or anything. But I know he wasn't considered fit for the job that he'd been doing. But he's a wonderful cross-country runner. And I knew him under two names, Silva, and he was a Brazilian under the name of Silva, and then another name that he had, which was French. In any case, I'd known him, and he was a wonderful swimmer. And the last thing that I'd heard about him was that he'd deserted with a German or a Scandinavian, and the Scandinavian had been drowned crossing the Black River in, or the Red River in, flood, and Silva had got to the other side. And he was, you know, people still thought that he was a member of the Second Bureau, the Intelligence Bureau. And he might have been, you know, I wasn't too much involved in it at that time. And so, but he was a funny character, as far as I was concerned. And she was engaged to him. Where, how, I don't know. You see? And so I said, well, it doesn't mean much to me, do you see? And so I worked on it hard. And then I invited them for the next night up to Prince's. And Prince's, where, you know, I used to go there pretty regular. And it was the eating place in town, and one danced. And there was an upstairs room where, you know, the Americans used to dance and jig, and there was better music upstairs than there was down below. And it was mainly, you know, where the one that was killed in the aircraft,
Glenn Miller.
Glenn Miller.
Yes.
Glenn Miller sort of music, which pleased me very, very much indeed. And so, and what's more, you know, downstairs was not the place for the Legion. If you get it's very, very posh downstairs.
More atmosphere upstairs.
More atmosphere upstairs. And so we went upstairs and we had this long table, and I suppose there were six or seven of the Legion, Janine and myself. And across there were quite a number of Americans, and we were dancing in the middle, you see, and I was dancing with her all the time. And she was sitting over there, and I was sitting over this. I was sitting over this side, and, you know, danced several times with her, and the American... One American in particular, you know, who was quite drunk, you know, he tried to separate us and all that sort of thing, and I told him to push off, and, you know, and he just wouldn't have it, you see. And then we sat down a couple of times, and he came up, and I told him to, you know, to go away, that she wasn't interested in him. And then he came over, you see, and he said, well, you know, and he sort of pushed my shoulder as if he wanted to start something, and so I said, you know, I'm warning you, you know, we've got the leader of French Foreign Legion here, so, you know, don't start any trouble, for heaven's sake, because you will be in trouble. And so he said, I'll take a lot of you on, do you see, and he made to hit me, and seconds later, you know, he's flying across the dance floor and under a table, which of course
he was just thrown.
Something like that.
Yeah, right.
And that's where he went. And so, of course, his colleagues, his friends, his American friends, a dozen of them at least, you see, all got up and came across in a bunch, you see. And so I said, right, Legion, you know, to me, and there we were. And, you know, before very long, you know, the Americans were putting their hands up and saying, all right, we've had enough. And the American police came in, the MPs came in too. Because somebody had called them the military police, yes. The Americans. And so I met up with the lieutenant that was with this gang of MPs, do you see, and I said, I'll take care of my lot, you know, and remember, I was in a major's uniform. And so I said, I'll take care of my lot across here, you take care of your lot, but get them out, I don't want them messing about with the Foreign Legion and with my girlfriend particularly. And so they were bundled out, they offered, and then the rest of the evening we really enjoyed ourselves.
I was about to ask you whether there was any antagonism between... you've answered the question.
Oh, yes, indeed.
Was there much antagonism between the Brits and the Americans in Calcutta at
that time? Again, there was a lot of antagonism. If they met up with each other and if they were drunk. Mm. It was all a question of drink and presence, you see. And as far as possible... They kept themselves apart as far as possible.
But were there that many Americans?
There were a lot of Americans in Calcutta at the time.
And was that a leave centre or not?
It was a leave centre,
as far as I can
remember. Yes, of course it was, yes.
I don't know.
No, it was. So there was trouble, and quite a lot of trouble, and that's, you know, but there was always the presence of the MPs.
How did the MPs behave?
Oh, they were rough. The American MPs were very, very rough.
Were they rough on everyone?
Rough on their blokes, on their own blokes.
But what about the Brits and the French?
No. Now, the MPs, the Brit MPs, I didn't see many of them. But the French, of course, didn't have any.
No. But I'm saying, were the American MPs rough on the Brits?
No.
Yeah.
They,